Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. So keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left. Relinquishment or Regulation by Jay Hughes. When people respond to technological threats to their lives, they do so against the economic and political forces weighing on them. In other words, controlling technological innovation is an inherently radical struggle. Some see the machines as their enemies, while others struggle to take the machines away from their masters. The first landmark of that struggle was the 1811 workers' movement in Britain that blamed steam-driven factory machines for growing unemployment. The textile workers began a campaign of arson and machine wrecking and issued public statements that they were being led by a mythical General Ned Ludd. But like John Henry dying in his vain struggle against the jackhammer, the Luddites were quickly and decisively crushed. On the other end of the spectrum, the utopian socialists and then the Marxists embraced industrial technology. For the utopians and Marx, technology promised a new age of leisure and prosperity. Rather than attacking machines, they pointed to the exploitation of workers by the owners and the capitalist state. Any problems arising from the new technologies would be eliminated when workers established human priorities over profit and domination. Marxian socialism argued that the advance of industrial civilization was in fact necessary to lay the foundation for the egalitarian society to come, in which all humanity would be freed from the drudgery of necessary labor. Industrial trade unionists and socialists, along with people generally around the world, embraced technology, science, and industrialization, despite isolated frictions over automation or dangerous work conditions. The early 20th century American left, the Progressive Movement, and the New Deal attacked the horrific working conditions of industrial work and the threats to public safety and unregulated consumer goods, but the solutions they proposed were to empower regulators and trade unions, not to ban science or industrial innovation. After World War II, however, nuclear weapons raised a fundamental new challenge to the union of technology with progressive politics. Although every advance in weaponry has inspired horrific calls that the end of civilization is at hand, nuclear weapons were significantly more likely to make the end of civilization a reality. The post-war peace and disarmament movements were followed quickly by Rachel Carlson's alarming work on environmental toxins, which helped launch a radical environmental critique of industrial civilization. In the hands of totalitarian regimes, both Nazi and Stalinist, science and technology had become horrific tools of repression, and the emerging New Left was infused with a Marcusean critique of industrial society and the romantic pastoralism of the counterculture. From Berkeley free speech leader Mario Savio's famous speech that people of conscience are called upon to throw their bodies, quote, on the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus of the machine and make it stop, to the anti-nuclear power organizing of the late 1970s, the pro-science and technology attitudes of progressives were quickly supplanted by neo-Luddism. Progressives began to give up on the idea that technology could be used in liberatory ways and that it was their responsibility to build support for stronger and more democratic regulation. Instead, strident neo-Luddite voices from anti-genetics organizer Jeremy Rifkin to philosopher Kirkpatrick Sale to the monkey wrenchers of Earth First began to articulate a call to relinquish technology altogether. Anti-biotech activists today regularly destroy research facilities, and the only advocates for a better future through technology were corporate-friendly liberals and conservatives. As the nation-state grows ever weaker in the emerging global political economy, concerned, mobilized citizens no longer trust that regulating technological risks for safety and efficacy will work. Increasingly, they want things banned, from cloning to biotech corn to nuclear power. It was into this fertile landscape that Bill Joy stepped, the unlikeliest of neo-Luddites, the chief technologist and co-founder of Sun Microsystems, and the inventor of the computer language Java. In April 2000, Joy published a jeremiad in the unlikeliest of places, the militantly pro-technology Wired magazine. Joy had developed a serious case of anticipatory doom as he contemplated the potentially apocalyptic consequences of three technologies: genetic engineering, nanotechnology, and robots imbued with artificial intelligence. The key and qualitatively different threat that Joy saw in these technologies was that they can all potentially self-replicate. While guns don't breed other guns and go on killing sprees, gene-tailored plagues, future robots, and nanophages can theoretically do just that. Let's take a second to review the proposed threats. The intentional design of bacterial and viral weapons began in a large way in the 1960s in the US and in the Soviet Union. In the 1980s, the techniques for recombinant redesign of viruses and bacteria became available, and those techniques were applied to smallpox and other vectors before the collapse of the Soviet scientific infrastructure. Tons of weaponized anthrax and smallpox have disappeared from the vaults of the Soviet bioweaponeers, and some of it has presumably been sold to third world countries, such as Iraq, along with some of the scientists who created them. Today, many nations and organizations have access to the technical knowledge and tools necessary to begin a program of bioweapons research, and in particular, experiments with genetic manipulation of biological agents. For instance, although very poor, Cuba has a thriving genetics and biomedical infrastructure, which uses recombinant DNA methods to produce vaccines and, according to one report, bioweapons. The genomes of plague, smallpox, cholera, and other pathogens are public knowledge posted on the internet. Using genetic technology, organisms could be designed to combine the virulence, latency, and lethality from a variety of sources to only attack specific races or body parts, or to be resistant to antibiotics and antiseptic methods. Soviet bioweapons program engineered antibiotic resistance anthrax and attempted to combine smallpox and Ebola. Although warnings about gene-tailored bioweapons have been sounded for a decade, since September 11th and the anthrax attacks, the threat has suddenly galvanized action. The National Institutes of Health and the National Academy of Sciences have convened emergency meetings to address the future threats from tailored bioweapons. However, Joy is not only concerned with the intentional release of gene-tailored infectious agents designed as tools of mass destruction, but also with the accidental release of genetically engineered microorganisms designed for benign purposes that might have similar catastrophic effects in our bodies or ecosystems. The key to effective gene therapy has been to find viral vectors sufficiently virulent that they would spread the beneficial genes throughout the affected person. Researchers have explored everything from the common cold to HIV as vehicles of gene transfer. Therapeutic success carries the risk that a gene-tweaking plague could have unintended consequences if spread to others. Australian researchers recently discovered that they had created a smallpox virus with 100% lethality for mice while trying to create a viral contraceptive. Bacteria engineered to clean up oil spills could mutate to eat plastic. Biotech crops could slip out of their farms and wreak havoc on local ecosystems. As for nanotechnology, the threats from nanotechnology and robotics are more speculative and farther in the future. Nanotechnology is the science of making machines at the nanometer level, which could eventually manipulate individual atoms or molecules and even build up copies of themselves. Although this holy grail of a programmable universal replicator is estimated to be 30 to 40 years off, the September 2001 issue of Scientific American is devoted to advances in this field, and the U.S. government is spending $500 million on nanotechnology research. The European Union, Russia, China, India, and Iran, and many other countries have nanotechnology research and development programs. The apocalyptic scenario associated with nanotechnology is known as gray goo, in which a set of replicators escape their program constraints and begin eating everything, destroying all life on Earth. Greg Bear depicted this scenario first in 1985 in his novel Blood Music. According to one estimate, nanobots could eat the Earth entirely in about 1 week. The gray goo problem has consumed a great deal of attention from aspiring nanotechnologists, and some convincing proofs have been published showing that masses of nanomachines of any size would starve, burn themselves up, or have to grow slowly enough to permit countermeasures. Nanoengineers have proposed industry standards for making nanomachines dependent on specific resources or self-limiting in their replication to prevent outbreaks of nanoplagues. Blue goo or nanoimmune systems could be deployed to detect and destroy gray goo. Nonetheless, the threats of widespread destruction through the intentional or accidental release of destructive nanomachines will be very real. As with biotech, even ordinary industrial applications could go seriously awry. Finally, and most speculatively, Joy waxes eloquent about one of the oldest tropes of science fiction, that robots might take over the world and destroy humanity. Says Joy, superior robots would surely affect humans as North American placentals affected South American marsupials, and as humans have affected countless species. That is, biological humans would be squeezed out of existence, end quote. Joy's concern about self-willed, self-replicating robots is tied up with the extrapolations of Hans Moravec, Ray Kurzweil, and others about the eventual emergence of machine minds. Computing power has doubled every 18 months for the last century, an observation dubbed Moore's Law. Maintaining that exponential growth rate, personal desktop computers will match the neural complexity of the human brain by 2012, and the memory storage capacity of the human brain by the year 2019. If self-awareness and other features of living minds are emergent properties out of complex information processing, the complexity of all the information technology connected through the internet will reach human brain levels well before 2012. In the Terminator movies, machine minds arose in military computers and decided to wipe out human beings, and many in cyberculture assume that the emergence of AI will be an apocalyptic event. Joy concludes that we need to return to the peace movement's efforts to have all nations renounce the development of weapons of mass destruction and apply it now to genetic, molecular, and AI research. Quote, these technologies are too powerful to be shielded against in the time frame of interest. The only realistic alternative I see is relinquishment, to limit development of the technologies that are too dangerous by limiting our pursuit of certain kinds of knowledge. Joy's calls for relinquishment have had little effect on policy deliberation, but has added weight to the growing neo-Luddite movement against biotechnology, which has now added nanotechnology and AI to the list of technologies they would like to see banned. This is an essay, Relinquishment or Regulation, by Jay Hughes. Many critics have dismissed Joy's concerns as science fiction, meaning they do not believe in the possibility of superplagues, nanorobots, and self-willed AI. But even if these threats are of very low probability, we have to take seriously even the slightest threat of so huge a catastrophic event. I agree with Joy that the apocalyptic threats from these technologies are very real. It may be that the likelihood of self-destruction with these technologies is one reason for the apparent scarcity of intelligent life in the galaxy. Before the first atomic chain reaction was tested at the Trinity site in Nevada, Edward Teller announced calculations showing that the test would ignite Earth's atmosphere in an uncontrolled chain reaction. Robert Oppenheimer was so troubled that he consulted his mentor, Arthur Compton, who suggested a risk-benefit calculation, that losing the war to the Nazis would be the better bet if the risk of destroying the Earth's atmosphere was 3 in a million or more. By the time of the test, the Trinity team had proven that igniting the atmosphere was a theoretical impossibility. But how much of an impossibility is still too possible? How do we know when we have passed the 3 in a million chance? And is this even the appropriate level of risk to take with the future of life on the planet? How large must the potential rewards of some line of research be to gamble with human existence? On the positive side of this apocalyptic calculus, the new technologies hold enormous promise, unlike nuclear weapons or even nuclear energy. Like the pastoralist Luddites, Joy belittles their benefits, saying, quote, this time, unlike during the Manhattan Project, we aren't in a war facing an implacable enemy that is threatening our civilization. We are driven instead by our habits, our desires, our economic system, and our competitive need to know, unquote. Yes, but these technologies also hold out the possibility of ameliorating human suffering and easing the burden of poverty and hunger in the world. Nanotechnology and genetics may indefinitely extend the lifespan, expand the mind, and sharpen the senses. There is a much stronger promise of benefits from their exploration than we ever had from nuclear science. Responding to the very real threat from our existing stockpiles of nuclear weapons, the disarmament movement has argued for 50 years for a verifiable ban on their production. The logic of such a ban is still sound, but the production of nuclear weapons is fundamentally different than the production of gene, nano, or info weapons. Nuclear weapons labs and testing facilities are dramatically different from nuclear medicine labs or nuclear power plants. Nuclear weapons can be banned without banning nuclear medicine and nuclear power. While a lab doing beneficial genetics, nanotechnology, robotics, or AI research is very similar to a lab engaged in gene, bio, or infoweapons work. U.S. arms control experts are acutely familiar with this problem because of the United Nations Special Commission in Iraq, UNSCOM's experience in identifying Iraqi chemical weapons production. Despite having complete access to all chemical and biological labs and all lab documents that they could find without notice, inspectors were unable to verify that peaceful production facilities were being used to make weapons. American inspectors testing the verifiability of weapons production in American medical labs in the 1990s had the same difficulty. The conclusion drawn by Bill Joy would be that this is precisely why we need to close down all labs doing research in these areas. Unfortunately, complete relinquishment is nearly impossible compared to the difficult but achievable creation of a transnational regime of technology regulation. Bill Joy's proposal is perfectly understandable coming from an engineer and corporate chief. If a new line of R&D in the firm promises to open the firm to huge liabilities and uncertain rewards, you stop the research. But the world is not, or not yet, as easily controllable or administered as a corporate R&D lab. The appeal of relinquishment has a vanishingly small chance of success, and is therefore a dangerous distraction from the more serious and plausible courses of action that can be taken to prevent apocalypse and lessen its impacts. The only safe and feasible approach to the dangers of emerging technology is to build the social and scientific infrastructure to monitor, regulate, and respond to their threats. Relinquishment is impossible and undesirable for several reasons. The first reason: banning all research into the new technologies would also stop the development of prophylaxis and treatment for their dangers. Joy praises the U.S. signing of conventions against bioweapons, saying that, quote, our attempts to deal with weapons of mass destruction in the last century provide a shining example of relinquishment for us to consider. The unilateral U.S. abandonment without preconditions of the development of biological weapons. This relinquishment stemmed from the realization that while it would take an enormous effort to create these terrible weapons, they could from then on easily be duplicated and fall into the hands of rogue nations or terrorist groups. However, Joy is calling for much more than the unilateral reduction and renunciation of bioweapons, nanoweapons, and infoweapons. He is also asking us to forbid research into peaceful applications, vaccines, and countermeasures. Unilateral renunciation of the development of chemical and biological weapons does not threaten the U.S. or world security, since one tool of mutually assured destruction, nuclear weapons, has been quite enough. Verifiable multilateral agreements forbidding weapons research are wonderful. But the world will not be safer, but in fact more dangerous, if the U.S. and Europe unilaterally forswear research in the new technology fields. After the United States signed the Biological Weapons Convention in 1972, and Richard Nixon dismantled the U.S. chemical weapons program, the Soviet Union and a number of other signatories secretly expanded their bioweapons programs. Because we have a thriving biomedical infrastructure in the United States, we have several widely available antibiotics to treat anthrax, equipment for the rapid identification of biocontamination, and we have been able to arrange for the production of enough smallpox vaccine to inoculate all Americans by year's end if necessary. It would be foolish for any democratic group of nations with relatively open societies to forbid all research in the new technologies, even medical and industrial research in these areas, when they will be necessary to prepare for the eventual hostile or accidental release from non-cooperating nations and groups. Another reason: the emerging technologies are required to help us prepare for non-technological existential risks. I concede that these technologies pose a, quote, existential risk, that is, a risk of human extinction, which appear to make a risk-benefit calculus useless. Unfortunately, existential risks abound, and do not just arise from human technology. The threat of human extinction from threats such as naturally occurring antibiotic-resistant plagues, asteroid impacts, or gamma-ray colliding suns are small, but they are real. Only the advance of new technologies promise to make humanity powerful enough to survive the various existential challenges that we may face. At the margins of prediction, technological renunciation may be as existentially risky as technological progress itself. Another reason: regulation must be global,
and that will be impossible
if the goal is to ban the technology. To regulate the new technologies at the depth required to prevent apocalyptic outcomes, we need to create new global regulatory institutions. Enormous forces will be arrayed in opposition to their creation. The first will be the alliance of corporate interests who stand to profit from less fettered research and development. The second will be the various citizen and consumer beneficiaries of the new technologies, from patients receiving new treatments to those receiving cheaper dwellings, new clothes, better food, and better educations. Every step forward with biotechnology, molecular engineering, robotics, and information technology will create enormous popular as well as corporate constituencies. Any effort to slow scientific progress will be vigorously fought. Occasionally, Luddite forces such as the Right to Life movement in the case of stem cell research may erect roadblocks, but in the end their efforts will prove meaningless as research continues in other countries, such as England, which is publicly financing embryonic stem cell and therapeutic cloning research. Even cloning, which has inspired paranoiac hysteria far out of proportion to any actual threats that it poses, may be impossible for international regulators to prevent as offshore havens shelter experimenters. As we slowly create transnational regulatory institutions, a third source of resistance will come from the less developed world, seeing that invasive safety regulation will make it more difficult for them to benefit from the new technologies. One of the most contentious issues in global climate talks has been the impact of environmental regulation on economic and industrial progress in the less developed. Even if we could coerce or convince developing nations to cooperate with bans on technologies, it would only force the research underground, making it impossible to regulate or monitor. I believe we will build strong global institutions in the next couple of decades capable of technology regulation. But there will be no support for global governance that attempts to deny consumers, patients, corporations, and developing countries the right to benefit from the emerging technologies at all. Global regulation of the new technologies will only be possible if it is focused on safety and not on abolition. Another reason: gene, nano, and info labs are small and easily hidden. Unlike nuclear weapons facilities, laboratories capable of offensive or simply accidentally dangerous biological nano or info research can be very small, the size of a small home, and easily hidden. Unlike telltale radiation signatures of nuclear research, satellite reconnaissance cannot detect the new technologies. Even if we were able to ban all research in these fields, nations and private organizations would have enormous incentives to conduct research in private. By allowing open beneficial research and attempting strict controls on that research, we have a better chance of reducing industrial accidents and keeping scientists from destined settings. You're listening to Relinquishment or Regulation by Jay Hughes. The existential risks posed by the new technologies do require a qualitatively different response than those given to previous toxic or dangerous technologies, a response which is more urgent, more preemptive, and which supersedes concerns such as national security or economic impact. The emerging technologies join nuclear weapons and global warming as problems best solved by the creation of strong supranational regulatory agencies empowered to monitor compliance with international industrial protocols and to penalize violators. As an early weak model, we have the International Atomic Energy Agency, which was established in 1957 by the United Nations to monitor the safety of nuclear reactors in member states and their compliance with agreements not to divert fissionable materials to nuclear weapons under the non-proliferation agreements. As of August 2001, 57 countries have signed on to the additional protocols agreement of the IAEA, which would allow unannounced inspections of facilities and the deployment of permanent monitoring equipment where there is nuclear material. Improvement, but still short of the types of aggressive investigation into nuclear proliferation with effective sanctions for non-cooperation that are necessary. The difficulty has been that nations have not ceded sufficient authority to the IAEA and to the United Nations in general to allow them to aggressively monitor and enforce the mandate. As a consequence, there are now half a dozen new nuclear states. Even the isolated and defeated Iraqis have been able to evade and then stop inspection of their nuclear, biological, and chemical weapons programs. But it has not been Iraq or North Korea which has forestalled the strengthening of international arms control verification, but the United States. The Bush administration shocked our allies last July by refusing to sign on to any new strengthened protocols for the Biological Weapons Treaty. Although since September 11, the administration has called for some tightening of the international treaty, making it a crime to buy, build, or acquire bioweapons, it continues to oppose the mandated openness and spot checks favored by the rest of the world. The administration continues to insist that international inspectors should not be allowed to spot check American corporate and military biotech laboratories on the grounds that this would threaten national security and the intellectual property rights of American corporations. Instead, the administration wants inspection only upon suspicion that there has been bioweapons activity in a signatory country. Although this would be a reasonable approach for punishing bioweapons manufacturers with low lethality technologies, only an international regime capable of imposing mandatory prophylactic inspections and controls, as favored by all our allies, is adequate in an era of apocalyptic self-reproducing technology. Since much of the technology which must be regulated is commercial and not military, effective prophylaxis will also require surveillance, controls, and penalties to be exercised over industries. Far beyond the weak and unenforceable environmental and worker safety quotas tacked onto existing WTO and GATT agreements, prophylaxis against existential risks requires an international army of industrial inspectors spot-checking research and development facilities. Global surveillance for the signs of aberrant technology will also require strengthened satellite monitoring for the heat signatures of rogue nanotechnology, and strengthening public health systems worldwide to permit identification of new epidemics, gene typing of the pathogens, rapid containment and development of countermeasures. You've been listening to part one of Relinquishment or Regulation, Dealing with Apocalyptic Technological Threats by Jay Hughes. Part 2 will be broadcast next week. You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about today's show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3 thanks to the A Infos Radio Project. Also at www.changesurfer.com are instructions on how to order copies of our shows and myriad relevant links. So educate, agitate, and organize. And I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.